Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, we take on Brexit. Try as we might, we can avoid it no longer. Lee, stop rolling your eyes. But we'll try and cut through the political mayhem and focus on your finances, as well as working out why it all reminds Simon of vacuum cleaners. Also, laughably, and I say this as someone who spent many a long evening, morning, lunchtime, forever debating the subject, we think we may also have time to cover DNA self-testing kits, the best and worst funds, and challenger banks. But we shall see about that. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, for a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
Now, as much as we have tried on this show to avoid it, can anyone escape the Brexit bedlam that has been playing out before our eyes, particularly over the last week, though one might suggest it's been going on rather longer than that. In between backstops, trade deals, Norway, plus, contempt of Parliament, no confidence, withdrawal votes. What is really going on? Are we going to leave? Should we really have a second referendum? And can you do anything to Brexit-proof your cash? Does anybody know? I won't pretend that we will, but heck, we'll give it a bash as we always do. So Simon, let's have a little recap. 2016, we went to the polls. We decided to leave. We had a date and everything, and that date is about 3 months ago. So naturally, we are completely ready and raring to go, yes?
Yes.
Great.
It's almost as if Brexit is being run by a bunch of journalists who are notorious for not doing anything until the deadline that they have. In fact, actually, it is being run by a bunch of journalists, it seems, because journalists are notorious for doing things after the deadline they've been given. It would have been nice if we had a plan. That was, I believe, one of the first things we discussed after the Brexit referendum. When it emerged that of the two camps, the Leave camp, which was the one that was not pushing for the status quo and therefore probably needed a plan as to what would happen next, turned out to not really have a plan. And in fact, actually, all of the people who had been the main cheerleaders of Leave just suddenly sort of absented themselves. And Theresa May was left to pick up the pieces. She has bravely battled on.
Someone points out, stamina is not a strategy.
Stamina is not a strategy. The strategy has been slightly confused by statements such as Brexit means Brexit and no deal is better than a bad deal, apparently both of which do not stand true anymore.
Yeah.
However, after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, Mrs. May came back with her deal and Parliament decided they didn't like the deal. And the main problem with the deal...
Parliament didn't really get a say on it, though, did it?
Well, Parliament didn't get a say on it because Parliament didn't like the deal so much that they didn't put it to a vote.
Exactly.
I mean, I think it's pretty clear and that Parliament doesn't like the
deal. The mayhem of this week.
Yeah. So we have the Tory party that is riven between two factions. You've got the sort of extreme Brexiteers on one side. You've got a small number of extreme Remainers on the other side. And then you've got the people in the middle who would probably rather remain. But seeing as people voted for Brexit, they're going to back Brexit. But they'd really rather that we did it in the most sensible course of action possible. You've got the Labour Party, which largely in the middle of the Labour Party, they think the same thing as people in the middle of the Tory Party. But also the leadership of the Labour Party see this as their best possible way of getting into power. So they're doing everything they possibly can to frustrate the government because they're eyeing up their own success. And on the other side of it, you have the entire nation going, what on earth are you doing?
So what you're saying is Brexit is being used by politicians and companies and journalists for their own ends.
It is a political football.
Yeah.
And I would describe it as similar to a political football in a football match being played by 7-year-olds, where the ball goes off in one direction and everybody suddenly runs after it, and then the ball goes back in the other direction and everybody suddenly runs after that. But the big problem is Northern Ireland and Ireland and this backstop arrangement. The issue is that we cannot leave the EU and not remain in a customs union with the EU because there is a border. Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland are joined together. So all of a sudden there would be a land border For the EU. So you would need to put a hard border in between them. But we can't have a hard border between them because of the Good Friday Agreement, because of the troubles in Ireland over the years. And so we can't put a border in the Irish Sea because obviously Northern Ireland is part of Britain and doesn't want a border between it and Britain. And there is no way of magically having a border. So we keep going around in circles. And the problem is that we came up with this backstop idea that if we couldn't come up with a magical way of dealing with it, we'd just stay in a customs union. But we can't leave that of our own accord without the EU's agreement. So therefore, we could be stuck in the so-called backstop forever. The EU could hold us hostage and keep us there. Now, the issue with this is that the other plan that the Labour Party has, which is to stay in a customs
union...
Loosely defined, presumably has exactly the same issue. It's just their plan hasn't been put forward to Europe. But anyway.
But so essentially this is, and let's talk about finance, this is an insurance policy. So we may not actually need it. And some people might suggest, you know, we've won wars. We've won the World Cup. And we are falling apart over what is essentially an insurance policy. An important one, no doubt.
Yes.
Right.
But
do the public really get this? And I don't mean that in a patronising way. What are all the things that you're hearing from your readers?
Okay, so I think that the public 100% get this. I think that the public pretty much understand the situation. I think that they pretty much understand that it is an insurance policy and it's unlikely to be enacted. But I also think that they understand that they don't want to be held over a barrel by the EU. I think that one thing that has firmed up over the last 2 years in many people's eyes is the fact that leaving the EU might not possibly be the most sensible economic course of action. However, the EU is a pretty dreadful organisation, and it would have been nice if everyone could have worked to each other's mutual benefit if they could have respected the decision of Britain to leave the EU instead of making it as hard as humanly possible to do so and driving us towards a constitutional crisis. And I suspect that the end game going on here and the fact that they have refused to give any concessions or even the slightest hint of a concession to Theresa May on her poor tour of like European leaders go, please help me out, is to do with the fact that they now reckon they might be able to force a second referendum and that we don't end up leaving the EU.
Well, I'm going to ask you about that in a second. And do forgive us, regular podcast listeners, if you feel that we are just going over what's been gone over, because this is really the first time we've properly touched on Brexit for a reason, I think, largely, is that, well, does anybody know what is going to happen? I mean, we're going to talk about how to Brexit-proof your finances a little bit later, if you possibly can. And that's what I want to ask you is, can you?
Georgia, I think that I speak for the public, hopefully, when I say this. We're all just getting incredibly fed up with all this chat and all of this dragging of heels and all of this nonsense and all of this political turmoil, which is going in with the infighting with the Conservative Party, got an opposition party that have got no voice and not doing anything to actually make anything else happen. And if I'm being quite honest with you, I'm starting to really have a filter. Whenever I hear Brexit at home, I just turn over the television. I just can't bear any more of this nonsense. We've got things to be getting on with. It just feels like it's getting out of hand.
Such an important, monumental, historic decision, which has been denigrated in a way.
It has, exactly.
The mace was stolen from the bloody chambers.
I know. It's got out of control, Georgie. It's just all got out of control. And, you know, this week has really been one of these weeks where I've just actually sat there and thought, this country's turning into an embarrassment. What is going on here? There's just too much nonsense going on behind the scenes. And we've got to all pull together and just make this happen now. There can't be a second referendum. In my eyes, there cannot be a second referendum. I think you do that, and then you really do start to, you know, ask questions about democracy and how this country is operating. Okay, you could argue that people who voted didn't know this was going to be the outcome of it and that there was going to be such a hash made of Brexit, and that actually rewinding right to that, David Cameron just turning around and going, you know what, I'm not going to deal with this, so I'm going to go now. You know, all those sort of things, we just didn't foresee it happening. Yeah. And it's just now we've kicked the can so far down the road that we're at this point here where we've got 3 months to go until we're meant to be leaving the EU. And yet, still, as you've rightly just said, no one seems to be. Everyone's sort of none the wiser.
Yeah.
And I still don't actually really quite know how it's all going to play out. But from a personal finance perspective, you know what it means for your finances. We had a story that actually was very popular last week about how to Brexit-proof your finances. Which, if I'm being totally honest with you, is a little bit. It's just, to be honest with you, it's just kind of good personal finance tips anyway.
Which is actually all you can offer in this.
It is all you can offer in this.
Just general good advice.
Yeah, general good advice. And actually, one of the things I've seen this morning, which I thought was quite interesting, and one of the points that was in this is about currency. Of course, we've seen the pound really sort of crumble against the euro and against the dollar. And actually, we're at a point now, I saw on a story this morning on the BBC, that we are at airports at a point now where it's almost $1 to £1, which is absolutely incredible. Okay, airports already, you know, we know they offer bad rates, and if you're going to get your money there, you're going to get stung. But that's still quite significant, because when it went to €1 to £1 at airport, it's now more like 90 cents to £1. We're now talking about almost $1 to £1 at airports, and that is absolutely incredible when you think it wasn't that long ago when we were talking $2 to a pound. And a lot of people still have that in their mind about when they go to America. Well, I tell you what, if you go to the airport, you're going to be sort of stung there. So that was one of the points about, you know, sorting out your currency.
Other little tips I've got there?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's things like regularly reviewing your outgoings. Again, that should just be common practice, really. You've got to be now looking at seeing where you can trim back, basically. And we've had a story out today, which, again, I want to hit my head against the brick wall, about council tax rises and how much they're going to go up by next year. And it's actually incredible. When I was looking at the figures earlier, I mean, we're talking a couple hundred quid per household. Local councils just full of waste and full of rubbish. And I say it's full of rubbish in a bin, because, but no bin collected weekly anymore. But it's
Oh, you got on your soapbox, haven't you, this morning?
Sorry, Georgie. I've had a couple of hours sleep, and I'm just
being a new dad, I'm in
full ramp mode. But you know, also about having a we've been hamming this home for ever since we started the podcast, Georgie, about having an emergency savings pot. That is actually the number one tip, and they recommend having 3 to 6 months worth of current income.
Wow.
Which is quite a lot. But I mean, that's, you know, the sort of advice that Royal London are giving, because we don't know really what's going to happen, and we've had all sorts of noises from the Bank of England about house prices crashing 30%. Everyone's in a kind of state of flux. They touch on investing wisely, so basically, you know, it's all about diversification and keeping on top of all of that. And also a big worry, actually, and I've had a look at my pension pot from the last year and the performance, and it's actually triggered me into action after I've seen the returns, the lack of returns on my pension in the last 12 months.
Meaning, what are you going to do with it?
Well, I've actually already done it. I've upped my contributions, which I feel very, very sort of pleased about. I love doing that. It's some sort of like weird feeling. I think it was from the podcast last week where Simon, I remember saying, a lot of people just sort of, we put it off and put it off and put it off, you know, financial decisions. And I thought, no, do you know what? I'm looking at it. I'm just going to up it now. I'm not going to sit on my hands and go, oh, let me just crunch how much. I'm just going to do it. And I've spread around the risk of my pension funds and everything. So I've actually looked a little bit more globally. And so it's all about having a good blend in your pension. So that's what Royal London are saying. So actually, if you're in that category and you don't, there's so many people that, A, get confused about their pension anyway, and that's half the battle, is to get people to be saving into it. And auto-enrolment, of course, kind of helped that problem. But the next thing is how to get people interested in what their pension is actually invested in. I would urge you to have a look, see the performance history. If you've got it, just
it's also giving people confidence as well, because you don't want to be messing with something that's so fundamentally important.
Exactly that. And the thing is, I didn't spend absolutely ages on this, because again, I was worried about spending ages and not putting anything into action. But I looked at all of the different funds that were available. I looked at the performance history from the last sort of 5 years and how they've performed in the last year. And it looked at the ongoing management charges and made a decision from there. And I've got a better blend in my pension pot now. I'll let you know this time next year if that was successful or not. But I think a lot of people might have all their eggs in one basket because they're just in the default fund and not looking properly at what it's invested in.
Can I just say congratulations, Lee. You've managed to get us off Brexit and onto pensions. And the look on your face. I never thought pensions would bring that smile to your face. So it's not Brexit proofing. It's basically how can we use Brexit as a really good reason to take a look at our finances and to just do what is best practice anyway.
And if we weren't leaving the EU and Brexit wasn't happening, I would just be saying to do it anyway.
Absolutely. But you did. I'm sorry, we can't go off Brexit for that much longer, because Simon has been penning an article, actually, about Hoovers and Brexit. And it's got nothing to do, actually, with how powerful they are or anything like that, or EU red tape, which some people might remember a few years back with your hairdryers and all that. You're actually drawing a parallel about the second referendum and whether we should have one and Brexit generally, Simon. I'm with Lee on this one. I don't think we should have a second referendum. I voted to stay in, but I do respect the vote originally. So that's my view. Kind of let's get it done. But Simon, what do you think? Because you looked into this.
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to ask a question of why are we talking about this now? Why have we suddenly decided to actually lead on Brexit on the podcast for the first time in a very long time? Why did I decide to write that column? It's because we're at crunch point. We have 3 months to go, just over.
Yeah.
Except really we don't, because Parliament breaks up next Thursday. Nothing's going to happen before then. 29th of December through to 29th of March. So we've probably got less than 3 months to go. And what it looks like, increasingly, is that we are potentially going to see some form of no-deal, chaotic Brexit. That's what everybody's really worried about. Lorry park on the M20 because the lorries can't get over the channel, flights don't take off, things like that. And it's now starting to affect people's behaviour, deciding that maybe they're not going to move home, they're not going to put their house on the market, because they genuinely do think if we see chaos, there's going to be a major disruption, prices might fall. Mm-hmm. They're not booking holidays. So the Easter holidays fall just after we are meant to leave the EU. People would want to be booking those flights right about now. I personally want to book a flight for just after Brexit. I'm not going to book that flight now because I want to go to California. So do I book my expensive flights that then can't take off and we can't get out of the country?
Saying that, and just a quick one on that, would your travel insurance cover you for that?
Not clear, and we're looking into that at the moment as to whether you will be covered under travel insurance if it doesn't happen. I don't know. I mean,
I've been looking into this as well, and before all the brouhaha of this week, and I imagine with it all pointing to perhaps a messier Brexit, actually chances are they'll say
foreseeable event.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So business decisions, for example, businesses aren't making decisions because of this. They aren't hiring people, they aren't investing money, they aren't expanding, because they are increasingly looking at the potential for this chaotic no-deal scenario. And they're thinking, well, let's just wait until after then to see what happens, kind of thing. Let's wait till May, let's wait till June. If you get enough people doing that, it starts to cause problems. In fact, it's the kind of thing that starts to potentially hint towards kind of things falling, recession, that kind of stuff. Investing. People are thinking, well, I'm not going to invest my money now. Market's just going to crash because of Brexit, or everything's swinging around wildly. So, and the irony is that the economy is doing okay at the moment. So GDP growth isn't great, but GDP growth isn't that great around the world. But that is actually being impacted by the Brexit element. If it wasn't for Brexit, the GDP growth would be better. Wages are going up. Biggest real wage inflation for some time. Wages are up 3.3%. Inflation is not particularly high, to just below 2.5%. That's perfectly fine. Interest rates have risen a bit, could go up in the middle of next year. To be honest, that's a good thing. It's a sign of a healthy economy. Our banks are looking pretty much fine. You know, they're willing to lend money to people and everything and help the economy keep going. But people are now starting to not do things because 3 months down the line, they're going, maybe it is going to be chaos. And I think that what lies behind this is not Brexit itself. It is the fact that we asked a bad question in the first place. It was the question that backfired. Not necessarily Brexit that's backfired, it's the question.
Okay, and now you asked explain.
Me about, so you asked me about Hoovers. In 1992,
yes,
Hoover came up with a wizard idea of a promotion. It had a backlog of old Hoovers and washing machines, and it decided to give away a pair of free return flights to Europe to anybody who bought a Hoover product, a Hoover or a washing machine, that cost more than £100.
Now, that seems a very good deal.
It was a very good deal because the thing they were giving away was worth more than the thing that people had to buy.
Okay.
So people went out and they bought them. Now, fortunately, Hoover had done a load of deals with travel agents and told the travel agents that they could try and flog people expensive insurance and stuff off the back of it. And in those days, you could definitely get away with flogging a lot more stuff to people than you can now. And amazingly, it pretty much got away with it, despite the fact of the dubious financials of it. And then inexplicably, Hoover decided to up the ante and offered two free return flights to America to anybody who bought a Hoover product worth more than that price. All of a sudden,
why?
Who knows?
Okay.
And if you go digging into this, there was a great BBC documentary about it in the early 2000s. I don't know if it's the kind of thing you can find on iPlayer. I found the story about it the other day, but I also found another article about it that said that they spoke to a risk management consultant, and he basically refused to even give an opinion on it because he said, no, this is so stupid, just do not do it. Anyway, so they gave away these free flights. People rushed out, bought the products, tried to claim their free flights to America. They realised that they had a little bit of a problem on their hand, so they started trying to make them jump through more hoops, tell them they could only fly from certain airports that, for example, were on the other side of the country and everything. Stories started to emerge of people struggling to get their flights, but the problem was it snowballed, and because as more of these stories came out, more people realised about the deal, because this was in the days before the internet, social media, so they read it in the newspaper, they saw it on TV, they were like, wow, this is a great deal, so they rushed out to buy their Hoovers to get their free flights. All the people who'd already bought the Hoovers to get their free flights, reading stories about people struggling to book their tickets, rushed to book their tickets. And the whole thing went bananas. Right. There was a court action that was fought for 6 years. There was a man who took a Hoover washing machine repairman's van hostage. So the guy who was a farmer went outside, blockaded in the man's van with his car. This guy became a national hero who's featured on television. Apparently this went on for 13 days. In the end... Hoover.
I'm still trying to work out how this is getting to Brexit, but
half
it's a
million
story nonetheless.
Half a million free flights were owed to people.
Yeah.
Only 220,000 people claimed them. Hoover's reputation was absolutely destroyed. It was believed it lost £48 million on it. Its market share went from 50% in 1992 to 20% in 1995. And eventually, the brand had to be sold by its owner Maytag to an Italian company called Candy for a knockdown price at the end of it. Now, what does that have to do with Brexit? Mm. It was an idea that completely backfired, as was David Cameron's own promotion of vote for me and get a free referendum, which he offered to people in the election where they managed to get elected without coalition partners. He held the referendum, but he held a referendum where it was a simple question of leave or remain, with no asking of what people wanted from the leave element. So we have had to basically try to negotiate completely blind, and nobody has bothered to find out what people want.
How could you do that, though? How could you have made it so that people can express how they want it to happen or what they were particularly bothered about?
One idea would be that you don't have a referendum that is completely binary, leave or remain. Or that you have one that's two stages, leave or remain. And then once you've had the leave, you then have the, well, how do you want to leave? Do you want to remain in the customs union? Do you want to do all these other things? The other one is that you can actually, and you don't have to do this by just the old fashioned focus grouping or phoning people up and doing a survey, is you could actually have tried to find representative groups of people and then used methods that are used academically, you know, so they've got a fair amount of solidity behind them to try to work out what people wanted and what the chief things people wanted were. But we didn't really consult the country on what they wanted. So you've got some people who say people who voted for Brexit want A. You've got some people who say they want B. Some people who say they want C. Some people who say, well, they were just lied to and they don't even know what they voted for in the first place. And we've just gone round and round in circles. So I think that if we do have another referendum, which I don't think we should have, I think we certainly shouldn't have one that is leave or remain. You should not overturn the result of a vote that you have not enacted, because that is bad for democracy. But if we do have one, it has to be a different question. And I think that it should be take the deal, go back and get a better deal.
Well, the EU is saying look, or leave you're with not no deal. Going to be able to renegotiate.
Yes, but if you actually went to the country and said, here you go, these are the choices, and then you went back to the EU and said, we're at an impasse, OK? So none of us want a chaotic no deal. We have asked people what they want. That is one way of doing it.
Simon, you're talking about having this idea of a second referendum, not asking the first question, because I think, one, that would be, as Lee said, damaging to democracy. Also, just how embarrassing for this country going forward if we haven't even enacted Brexit and then we have to go and say, can you have us back, please? But having another referendum, asking another question, perhaps going back to negotiate, as again, as Lee pointed out, there are issues going on in this country that are being ignored because so much attention is being spent, you know, with our leader going all the way around Europe, trying to negotiate deals, coming back to Parliament. We've got schools to deal with, the NHS, police, all sorts of issues of our daily council tax, rubbish that is being left because of Brexit.
Yes. So actually, and I think the great mistake that was made was not making it a cross-party thing. If I think what Theresa May should have done is said, I am setting up a cross-party commission. It's going to have 12 people on it, 4 from the Tories, 4 from Labour, 4 from the other parties. Here are our 4 people. Now you put your 4
but
people on it.
But coulda, shoulda, woulda, we shouldn't have had Theresa May. We shouldn't have David Cameron, etc, etc.
Exactly,
but we are here.
But we are
so
here.
So extending it
But we'd
even
have
longer?
To deal with this problem. So what are we going to do? Just go, OK, well, we'll just leave with no deal then.
I told you we'd never get to DNA.
But do you see what I mean? So we have to confront this problem. We are talking about this because we are actually at crunch point now. We have to do something about this. I don't necessarily think we should have another referendum, but if we're going to have one, it should be something like that. But probably the best thing we need, the thing we need to do now is say, nobody has ever left the EU before. Actually, turns out it's much harder than everybody thought. The first thing we need to do is extend Article 50 and get the EU to agree to it, because this is not just our problem, it's the EU's problem as well. You know.
But again, you're kicking it the can down the road to a certain
We
extent,
are kicking the can down the road, but then what do we do? Rush a bad decision
else.
Then
well,
before
EU
March
say
the 29th?
They won't negotiate anything else. The only solution is to leave without a deal on March the 29th or to go back to the people and ask.
Well, then, exactly, we're at an impasse. And I don't think there's a great deal of support for the kind of chaotic no-deal exit that it's probably going to ensue. So this is where this push for the referendum comes from.
Lee, I've got to throw you in there just for a laugh. Go on, Lee.
I love that. Just throw me in for a laugh.
Just because I know it'll annoy you.
Well, look, at the end of the day, we've got 3 months and we're kind of at a point now where we're still sort of none the wiser. It feels like there's a lot of noise coming from Britain to EU and EU to Britain. You know, perhaps Simon's correct. Perhaps Article 50 does need to be extended for a brief amount of time. You know, maybe it shouldn't be such a hard and fast rule, because let's face it, whether you voted leave or whether you voted remain, now the way this is going is probably not agreeable to the majority of Britain. We don't want to be crashing out without a deal. We don't want to see years of recession. We don't want to go down that road again. And we don't want to see, you know, problems with Britain because of...
parties tearing themselves apart.
And let's face it also, let's say it gets to March and for whatever reason Theresa May's deal does go through and we leave, or we crash out of no deal. Let's not forget, there's going to be years of untangling other things from the EU. And actually, it was a good point someone just made there about actually how difficult it is to leave the EU. And I reckon countries across Europe are probably looking at this and going, oh, blimey. I mean, because let's face it, there's other countries in which there's been The EU hasn't particularly worked very well for some of the countries within Europe, I would argue, and citizens in some of those countries would say the same thing, much like it, you know, we were saying in Britain. But it's actually quite scary how difficult it has been to unmarry ourselves from the EU. We know they're our neighbours, right? And we know that we still want to trade with them and we want all this, that and the other. But we've got 3 months to go, Georgie. We've got now the time in which most people start to clock off and take it easy for a couple of weeks, which is Christmas and New Year. So then we're into sort of the first, second week of January. Then we're talking about 2 months to go.
Yeah.
The answer is, I don't know what the answer is.
Simon says we're getting to crunch point, but just a quick one on you sort of touched on it earlier when talking about how much we know about it. A lot of people are arguing that, you know, we know a lot more about Brexit now than we did when we went to the polls for the referendum, but do we? Do we really, really, really know, Simon?
Well, I will tell you one thing that we do know. In the run-up to the EU referendum, I wrote a column in which I listed 10 articles that I thought were well-researched, written by credible sources, balanced. So some were for leave, some were for remain, linking to them and saying, if you haven't made your mind up yet, these are the things that I would recommend reading. I hadn't made my mind up either. I went through all 10 of those articles the other day, and I looked for the word Ireland, Northern Ireland, and Irish. One of them. There was one mention once.
And what was that mention about?
It said that the Northern Ireland Ireland thing would be a problem, and it would be a problem with the peace process. But this was a professor who'd written this. It wasn't even a newspaper article. Did link through to something from the FT, and the Irish government apparently had said something about it. But nobody was talking about this. Literally nobody was talking about this in the run-up to the referendum. And the only other thing I'd say is, so we didn't know about that. And also nobody voted, whether they voted for leave or remain, particularly if they voted for leave, nobody voted for chaos. We were told there would be a plan and we would leave with a plan.
But we haven't actually left, though.
No, and this is the problem. We are at crunch point and it is becoming abundantly clear that there is a very real risk of us leaving without a plan. So we either need to come up with some kind of amazing solution in the next 3 months, or we need to extend Article 50 and tell the EU that we have to renegotiate, or we have to go down this route of another referendum, which I'm not sure I support.
Right, Simon, before we close this subject for now, I like looking at polls on your website, I have to say, and you have two up to gauge the mood of your readers with regards to the EU. So the first one you ask is, do you want another Brexit vote?
Yes.
What is the answer so far?
OK, so I asked this question yesterday. Do you want another Brexit vote? Currently, and you bear in mind, our readers are pretty Brexity, OK? No, 53%, that's 646 votes. And yes, 47%, that's 475 votes.
Bear in mind, you only put this up yesterday. That doesn't necessarily mean they would vote
that's
to
very,
remain.
That's very even, though. I would have... No, that's true. That's very... But that's very even. I would have expected no to be winning by a greater margin.
I'll ask
it's
you
also,
next week.
It's also wonderfully close to the leave stroke remain result in the referendum, isn't it?
Okay, so then, the second one you have, though, which you put up before the referendum, so it'd be interesting to see... If you'd have put that up yesterday, for example, would Britain be better off in or out of the EU? So what were the results in that one?
Right. So this was a poll that was put up originally in January 2016.
Goodness.
Okay, before the referendum. And it ran, most of these votes will have come before the referendum. And this was the thing that told me that the vote was going to be much closer than people thought. Now, you've got to remember that people thought that Remain was going to win by a sizable margin. Pretty much right up until the actual referendum, they were talking 60-40. So, would Britain be better off in or out of the EU? Out, 79%.
Wow.
60,549 votes. In, 21%. 16,232 votes. The learning I took from that and something that we discussed on this podcast before the referendum was that allowing for the fact that I know that a lot of our readers wanted Brexit and wanted to be out of the EU, even balancing it out for that, that indicated to me that it was going to be a lot closer to 50-50 in the answer than the 60-40 that was expected, and led me to think that there was a strong chance that we were going to vote to leave the EU, which was not a commonly held opinion in the run-up to the referendum.
It was not, but I would love you to refresh that and see what that poll would be like now. Just over the Christmas period, let's take a look in the run-up and we'll see how close it is.
Okay,
yeah?
And I'd just say, before we finish, there is a way that I think this series of Brexit could end.
Mm-hmm.
Final scene, David Cameron walks out of the shower. It was all a dream. The Bobby Ewing moment.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, let's move on from Brexit, shall we now, and have a bit of a pause. Now, I don't know about you, but I am seeing a heck of a lot of adverts for DNA self-testing kits. I even spotted one reading the Sunday Paper magazine supplements, and they had them in their perfect Christmas gift section. The idea is that for under 100 quid, you can get a kit through the post, and you basically spit into a tube or you dig out some poo and then you send it back, which seems an odd Christmas present, let's be honest. But the results can show you anything from your ancestry information. You can go on a website and find out if you've got long-lost relatives in Canada or something. They can also tell you things like your risk of developing certain illnesses or like what vitamins that you should be taking. Now, all sounds great, doesn't it? Even the health secretary is a big fan of genome testing. But should we hold our horses on this one a little bit? So, Lee, we've been looking into this together, but I'll ask you, why would you get one?
Georgie, this is a great story, because I could say that because you'd written it.
Hey!
And we worked on it together. And it was one of those things that I've seen in the last year, definitely, thinking about my own friends and family members who seem to be quite willing to give over, you know, basically a bit
your
of DNA.
Most intimate details,
yeah,
basically.
Kind of without much knowing what it all entails, to see where for a
who
bit
are
of,
these companies
for a bit of a laugh, yeah. just to see where their ancestry is from, or maybe to see if they're sort of intolerant of a certain type of food or whatnot. It's actually quite scary. And when you suggested looking into it, I was like, yes, that is something that has been on my radar.
So, I just kept seeing them everywhere on everywhere. My social
and
media
and I've seen quite a few television adverts in the run up to Christmas yeah. billing it as a perfect Christmas gift, and that is exactly why we had a look at it. And actually, I think people are just interested to see what their genetic makeup is, and the cost of these has fallen so drastically in the last mm-hmm. 12 to 18 months. I think people have been enticed in to give it a go.
A lot of sales on at Christmas as well. You're looking at about 69 quid.
Exactly that. And actually, a couple of months ago, my dad said to me, oh, I'm going to take one of his ancestry DNA tests. He was adopted, so he doesn't know much of his yeah. background. And it's kind of like, oh, Dad, you know, have you thought about any kind of implications? Oh, what do you mean? You know, he's probably a typical customer of someone yeah. that does something like this. And of course, when you actually start to scratch under the surface and think about it at the bigger picture and how these tests might be used in the future, or and we're talking the near future, and some of the issues, especially in the States that it's brought up, it's actually quite a scary prospect. So we looked at, didn't we, George? So the couple of things that we're worried about mm-hmm. is the insurance aspect. So will insurers demand that they get this information?
Which seems at some stage only right. If we've got all this information about us that could be telling us,
do you have
what
to declare
risk,
it? Yeah.
Why wouldn't health insurers want this information? Absolutely. Now, currently, we should say that there is a moratorium between the government and the health insurance industry to say that actually the benefits of genome testing outweigh this issue. But mm-hmm. that can be revoked at any time. It used to be every 3 years. That mm-hmm. changed this year,
while
didn't it?
While you're writing a story, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's an interesting aspect. Another interesting aspect is simply what these companies are doing with your personal, your intimate,
who
most
are
your,
they
mate,
as well?
You know, you know, who
are
they?
Companies? They're online.
There are a lot of mysterious companies that are sort of set up. A lot of them are based in the States. There's mm-hmm. a couple that are based in Europe. But if you're going to do one of these tests, make sure you know, fundamentally know, that if you can opt out of having your, this is the most intimate of yeah. your details. And it just feels people are sort of very willy-nilly about it. You wouldn't be like that with your bank account details or other details. I don't really quite understand. Yeah. If you don't know if it's going onto a database or what's happening with that, I'd really question it. And actually, one of the companies in the States sold a big swathe of data to GlaxoSmithKline, which is a British company. Did these people kind of know that's what was going to happen? Now, okay, you could argue that yeah. it's good for science and it's good for being able to, you know, see certain trends and patterns, perhaps in certain locations and things like that. But I think it worries me that it's all a bit Black Mirror for me.
There's also this ethical issue, because none of these testing kits, to my knowledge, offer genetic counselling. And it's not a diagnosis. We absolutely need to be clear, mm-hmm. because the way this works is you pull genetic data together and it shows a likelihood. Mm-hmm. So if you have a certain gene, it shows a likelihood to a certain condition. But if it links you to something that you can't do anything about, let's say dementia, mm-hmm. the emotional response to that, as we found out because we spoke to someone, could be really traumatic.
Well, this is it. So in the story, we had two case studies. So we had a couple that he was a scientist and he kind of understood how it all worked and kind of took it at face value, I would say. Mm-hmm. And he seemed relatively okay with the fact
yeah,
that
they enjoyed it.
They enjoyed it. On the flip side, we had the other case study of the lady who took the test and then found out that she was at more risk of dementia. And you wouldn't know that. There's no way that you would know that.
Before you take the test.
And you might not necessarily know when you take the test that you're going to be told something like that. You might have been doing it just for a bit of fun or whatever. And that's the other aspect of this. And this is the other worry about people just doing it quite willy-nilly. Perhaps you could argue, well, actually, it's a good thing because you can prepare. But you can't. There's nothing you can do for dementia.
No, absolutely. I mean,
and there's no guarantee that actually that's going to happen. You're now going to live the rest of your life in fear of the shadow of dementia because you've taken a test perhaps in your 30s that said, you know what, you're at an enhanced risk of dementia. The other thing about the DNA stuff, what if it turns out that your family's not who you thought they were?
All
you
know, sorts.
Okay, that might not happen very frequently, but I bet it does happen. And that could make a quite interesting Christmas tale, couldn't it?
Yeah.
How I got gifted an ancestry DNA kit for Christmas and it turns out my family wasn't my family. That's a bit like Jeremy Kyle episode, but I mean, it happens. It happens. I've seen stories across the internet.
And we're going to see more of it,
yeah, exactly.
We?
So I think that the sign-off on that, Georgie, is that if you are thinking about getting that as a Christmas present or you're just thinking about doing it in the next few months, just make make sure that, A, the company that you're using, just because it's the cheapest, doesn't necessarily mean it's the one that you should go for, because it might mean that you're giving up some of your personal data without being able to opt out. So just make sure that, you know, maybe you're happy to have the data put onto a database, but perhaps you're not. So make sure you can opt out if you want to be able to do that. And just remember that if you're going to take a test that might highlight certain medical issues, that you're going to have to deal with the aftermath of that. And, you know, it's no guarantee that you're going to get said disease or said condition, but you're going to have that in the back of your mind probably for the rest of your life. And do you really want to live like that? I'm not sure. There are people out there that I'm sure would want to live like that and prefer
it
to
depends
know.
It depends what it is. And, it, you know, these are 69 quid kits from the internet. So I'm not saying that they're not accurate. I'm sure they are. But they're not going to diagnose you. That's not kind of how it works. And don't, therefore, do something drastic like get a mastectomy or something if you, you know.
That.
That's the that's another worry.
And that's the danger. And then I would say the last thing is just to think about that potential. I mean, we had a line in the story as well about, well, where do we draw the line? You know, would a potential employer in the future say, oh, you know, I want to see your genetic makeup to see how often you're likely to be sick or how you might be off in a couple of years' time because you've got some underlying condition that might flare up? You know, where do you draw the line? And I think that is what you have to just be aware of. You've got to do your research before you use any of these companies. Don't just look at an advert on the television or in a magazine and go, oh, yeah, that looks interesting. That'll be a bit of a laugh this Christmas. Get it and then regret it.
This is not to say genome testing generally is not a good idea. It probably can be. And this is surely, though, Simon, the future.
It's not a future that I want to buy into, I'll tell you that much. You're talking to a man who won't even let his wife track him on his iPhone so that she knows where he is. I came home one day.
Is that what people do?
Yeah, they do. It's a thing. It's the Find My There's a Find My Friends app.
Tell us
and
more.
So my wife said, my friend was there, actually, and they just decided to do it with each other so they could know, so it'd be easier to find each other. Ed, my friend Ed, said that he had this.
Yeah.
And Catherine said, couldn't you do it as well? And I was like, no.
No.
She's like, word. Why not? And I was like, well, because that goes against everything I ever talk about that I believe in terms of surveillance society and my data and CCTV and everything else. She's like, well, it must mean you're up to something. I was like, well, I'm not up to something. I just disagree with it. So she can find out where our friend is, but she can't find out where I am.
Not just you.
She said, but it'd be really useful. When you're on your way home, I'd know where you are. So I'd know if you were cycling home or something. I was like, I don't care. I mean, I don't like CCTV society. The idea of ID cards, I was massively against that. Everybody's DNA being kept on a database. There are some people who say, well, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. I happen to have a slightly more dystopian view of society. I'm an optimist, but I also think that through history, there are many, many tales of people in power using things to their advantage. And I think that the less of your information that you hand over, be that your DNA, an ID card, CCTV, or letting your wife know where you are, the better.
But also I'm a bit more philosophical as well, in as much as that we have rights. They're intangible, but we need to protect those rights because of exactly what you said, because of things that we've seen in history. And things like privacy are so important. So there you go, there's DNA self-testing kits. But as predicted, we gassed on about Brexit a little bit too long. So we're going to have to shoot through investing. We've been looking at investment funds and trusts and the worst performing funds of 2018. I do appreciate we've got a couple of weeks to go yet. But Simon, we're going to literally just rattle through it in chart show fashion. Simon, the top performing funds?
The top performing funds of 2018 so far. In at number 20, we have Pictet Health.
God, are we going to go
number
from 20?
Number 19, Schroder Global.
Just give us the top one.
Top one. But that's not how the chart show works. All right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I'll do 10. Okay, ready?
All right, go.
In at number 10, Artemis US Smaller Companies. Number 9, we've got Baillie Gifford Global Discovery. Number 8, a new entrant, Blue Whale Growth. Number 7, Polar Capital Global Technology. Probably would have been doing better, but for the hit to the share prices of those fangs. Comgest Growth America. Ahead of that, we've got T. Rowe Price US Blue Chip Equity in at number 5. Number 4, another entry for T. Rowe Price US Large Cap Growth Equity. Number 3, Neptune Global Technology. Polar Capital Healthcare Opportunities. And number 1 for the week before Christmas, but not necessarily Christmas because things could change around, Baillie Gifford American.
Excellent. Do not adjust your radio sets. Simon is going through the top performing funds. Have we got the trusts?
Yes.
Just give us five, Simon.
Okay, we're just going to do the top five. Number five, the interestingly named Doric Nimrod Air 1. Then we've got BH Macro, EJF Investments 3, number two, Syncona, and number one, a favourite name, Linsall Train Investment Trust.
And let's go for the wooden spoon, Simon. The worst.
We're just going to go for the worst performer. We are not going to run through the list. The worst performing fund of 2018 so far, Jupiter India Select. And the worst performing investment trust, Catco Reinsurance Opportunities.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Simon. And finally, want to save, just can't seem to get into the habit, though. Lee was talking earlier about how Brexit should be a little reminder to all of us to get ourselves in gear when it comes to our finance. So, Lee, just keep awake for just a couple more minutes and tell us.
I don't know how to top the top 10 investments.
You don't have to do it in an exciting way. You just have to, because what we're talking about is getting into a saving mindset. And while technology's often been blamed for getting us out of that mindset, actually, technology's coming to the rescue to try and get us back in. And we're seeing a lot of challenger banks like Monzo and Starling offering some kind of nifty new tools to help us savers.
Yes.
So, Lee, going full circle back to Brexit proofing yourself, getting into the saving mindset, what are we seeing from challenger banks?
Yeah, I think actually it's quite an interesting concept, actually, because one of the hardest things to do when it comes to savings, and especially for younger people, is to think about, well, if you're starting from scratch, it's quite hard to get into the habit because you're thinking, well, after year one, I've only got a small amount. Is it worth it? The interest on offer is rubbish. Why am I going to bother? But once you get into that habit, in a couple of years' time, it would have snowballed into something a little bit juicier, which you can then reinvest and perhaps start to look building it even faster. So there's a couple of tools out there. So we've got Monzo's got a coin jar, which basically just rounds up your spending. So if you paid by, let's say, your phone £1.40 for a cup of tea, you can round it up £2.60p goes into the savings pot. They offer 1% on their savings pot account. One of the big boys, actually, Lloyds in Halifax, they've got something similar. They offer a low interest. So for Lloyds, it's up to 0.6%. And on Halifax, it's 0.2%. Starling, which I actually think is a very good challenger bank. Monzo seems to be getting all of the limelight at the moment, especially after the crowdfunding round it had last week, in which it got £20 million in a couple of hours, which is quite mad. Again, has a pot where you can sort of round up. You get 0.5% on that. But they actually offer something a little bit different in a multiplier. So you can multiply it up to 10 times more. That's quite high for people, but you could say maybe two or three times more. So that 60p example I just got, if you multiplied it by four, you had £2.40 going into a savings account instead. And it's a good way to encourage people to save that. Again, Tandem have something similar, a smart money app. That kind of prompts you to say, hey, look, you've been paid on this day. These are your bills that are coming out. You've got X amount that you could probably put into a savings account and be okay. So that kind of prompts you into doing it. Moneybox, which I think is a really interesting concept, especially if you haven't used your ISA allowance. This is a good way to dip your toe into investing because they round up spend and you can invest it into certain companies and whatnot. I mean, it does come with an annual platform fee of 0.45% plus a fund management fee of up to 0.24%. It's free for the first 3 months and also you have to then pay £1 a month after that. So it might not be ideal for everyone.
Good
but
for first-timers, I think.
Good for first-timers, isn't it? And the last one we've got is Brexit Bank, and you can put in, for now, I'm joking. But the point is that it's a good way to get yourself in the habit. And if you want to go old school, you should just set up a direct debit from your bank account, because if you're having to keep moving money on a month-by-month or a weekly basis or however it is that you choose to save, you're likely to put it off and go, oh, do you know what? I could actually do with that extra 50 quid this month because I'm going to the pub. If you've just got it set up as direct debit or in a rounding up tool like that, you're more likely to stay on track and actually build something substantial for the future. And we said earlier about building up an emergency pot of cash, and we've said 3 to 6 months salary sounds really high. You know, don't get put off by that. Just make sure you're putting away something each month.
A
you
target,
know, it's a target. And then after 3 years, say, you might have a few grand sitting around there and you go, cool, I've saved up, you know, £3,000, £4,000, £5,000. You could then start thinking about perhaps investing that. And hopefully by that time, you would have seen your earnings go up a little bit. And then you start topping up that pot with more money, and eventually you'll be a millionaire. Probably not, but maybe.
an aspiration, nonetheless. Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you very much for talking about Brexit. I know you weren't a big fan of doing that, but we sort of have.
No, it has to be done, Georgie. It's the biggest issue of the last couple of years, of course it is, and it will be in the next few years. And I'm just being grumpy because I'm just so fed up with the politicians and all of the posturing and all of the rubbish that's going on.
Good news is this is not going to be sorted out anytime soon, as you just said. So
excellent.
Yeah, it's good practice. Thank you, guys. Thank you also, Simon, of course. But if you have a question for the team or something you'd like us to cover, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all the podcast articles and leave us a nice Christmas message in the comments or just fight amongst yourselves.
Yeah,
and today's mild dose of podcast chaos was brought to you by No Deal Brexit.
Thank you very much, Simon. And also, please do vote in the polls as well. Interesting to know your responses. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and say something nice about us? Why not? Because it's Simon's big birthday this week. Happy birthday, Simon.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.